You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Welcome to the show, everybody. It's time for another episode. And this episode is very interesting and a direct result of you listening to this podcast, to be perfectly honest. So the Reverb.com folks have been working on a guitar pedal documentary. And for some reason, they saw fit to include yours truly in this documentary. And I feel like that's a direct result of my kind of obsession with these little boxes and the fact that you all tune in week after week to hear me talk to people about them. And that is just absolutely astounding to me. I've talked about it before, but thank you so much. Seriously, I get to do so many cool things simply because you tune in and download this little podcast. And yeah, it's just crazy. Anyhow, on this episode, Dan and Michael from Reverb come in to tell their stories about how they became involved with the company. They tell the story of the company a little bit, and then they talk about the movie that they've been working on. And it's crazy. It's like a full-blown, legit movie. Some of the details might have shifted around a little bit because this was recorded a few months ago in November. So this, I was asked to hold on to it for a little bit, cradle it, keep it safe, you know, kind of like a Bilbo Baggins with the ring. And so some of this might be a little bit different by the time you hear it and by the time the movie actually airs. Some of the details might have shifted a little bit, but the fact remains that there is a guitar pedal documentary that's going to exist and going to be released on streaming platforms sometime in 2020 is what they're guessing right now. Don't hold them to that, but that's what they're shooting for. And you can bet that I'll be shouting it from the rooftops as soon as I find out about it, because I am so excited to watch this. So without further ado, let's get into this episode with Dan and Michael. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Tone Mob podcast, a show about guitar tone and the people behind it. I'm your host, Blake Weiland, and with me today, I have Dan Orkin and Michael Lux from Reverb.com. What's going on, fellas?
Hey, buddy. Hey. Thanks for having us.
Oh, of course. This was a good time today. I mean, it's hard to, like, do a normal podcast episode now. We just kind of have to, like, pretend we didn't just film a bunch of stuff with Jack DeVille and me for some reason. But, man, you guys have kind of interesting stories to tell, so we should just kind of get right into it. So whoever wants to take the lead on this, what's your backstory? How'd you end up at Reverb doing what you're doing now?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been at Reverb since the company started, which feels like several lifetimes ago at this point, but it was in the fall, winter of 2012. I used to work at a different company in the MI or musical instrument industry. That was like a more kind of standard retailer. And just through being in the right place at the right time, I got connected with David, who is the founder of Reverb when the company was first starting up. Started working there, doing a variety of things. It was, you know, the startup grind when you're building a tech company and a music company, however you want to define it from the get-go. You do a lot of different jobs, and flash forward 7 years, still there, still here, still doing things. These days I mostly do work with Michael here doing our content, which would be our articles, our videos, and a whole bunch of other less exciting things that kind of fall into the content on the website.
Yeah, I had been a filmmaker and a musician pretty much in tandem since I was really young, probably about 7 or 8. And had done both of those, went to film school, but also toured in bands in Chicago. And that kind of led me to running my own post-production company, which led to me also knowing somebody who was around at the beginning days of Reverb, who's still there, and they needed a video director to start the channel. So about 5 years ago, I did exactly that. And to date, I think I produced around 2,000 pieces of content for Reverb.
That is crazy. That's a lot.
It's a lot, but not enough.
Not enough. No. Yeah, I know about that. There's never, you can never make enough content these days.
It's, well, there's just so much tone out there.
Tone, T-O-A-N.
Yeah,
tone.
There's always more tone.
Yeah. I should really change the name of this podcast to reflect what we're really talking about, which is tone, you know?
Absolutely.
Of course.
Yeah.
No, so Dan, like, I guess we can get right into it, like why you're here today, and then we can maybe go back and talk about the Reverb story a little bit more, but you're here shooting a movie, guys, like... We just shot part of a movie in the Shred Shed, and that's still really weird to me. like a real movie, not a YouTube thing. Not that YouTube can't be a platform for real movies, but
right.
You know, you guys have bigger plans for this thing. So maybe start from, you know,
sure,
wherever.
Yeah, Michael, jump in here if you want to have any sort of flesh this out. But you know, we've been making videos for Reverb for a while, and a lot of them are, I would say, in the same kind of ballpark as a lot of other creators who we really love and admire on YouTube and in other channels and ecosystems. And we've been talking for a while about potentially doing something a little bit bigger, a little bit more ambitious, and kind of trying to do something that's more of a love letter to the industry that supported our business over the years, specifically Music Gear. And I don't think I need to tell you that pedals and pedal buying and selling has been a huge part of the growth and culture of Reverb over the years. So this project is essentially us trying to make a full-length documentary about the history and community and culture around effects pedals. And like I said, because that community has been so supportive of us, it's been a real joy talking to a lot of the people involved with that, hearing their story, and trying to take all that information and pare it down into a story that anybody can understand is really compelling and really powerful and really special, regardless of if you're the deepest gearhead with your own shed shred in the backyard, or if you're just somebody who, you know, has maybe likes Jimi Hendrix or likes guitars more generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the interesting things, just about our experience in general, at Reverb is that we've gotten to know so many of these, folks behind the companies. And when you really think about it, as music enthusiasts and gear enthusiasts ourselves, obviously, it's been fascinating to put these pedals, these boxes, these engineered devices that have kind of changed music together with the human beings behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for the most part, you know, the people behind the companies haven't been told as much, and people associate effects as just these effects. But really there's deeper stories behind a lot of these iconic companies and a lot of these effects that have affected players for decades.
Yeah, you say they've changed music, sort of. I mean, I think they've totally changed music. You know, obviously I'm extremely biased, and that's not a pedal joke, but I guess it is now. it's just, I don't know, the way we kind of talked about it when you were filming me, but the way they just drastically changed the sound for relatively inexpensively for how drastic the change is. I think they've without a doubt just completely changed music and, kind of like you were talking about earlier, like how the pedals inform the music. You said Steve Albini was talking to. Wait a minute, you guys were talking to Steve Albini. Let's wrap our heads around that first of all.
Sure.
I'm not sure where I'm going with this line of talking.
Well, I think it's the feedback loop, and that's part of the story here that we're trying to tell. Is back in the day when pedals were first being invented and coming out, and in researching this project, we've learned a lot about this. I think there was more of a sense of them being tools that achieved a certain sonic end.
Mm-hmm.
This is not unique to pedals. It exists in every facet of music gear and music production history, where something happens by mistake, somebody tries to replicate that mistake, and then there's a whole industry or whole lineage of gear that comes around to further that and extend that mistake or extend that happy accident that happened in the studio one day. You know, tape flanging, maybe somebody bumped into a tape machine one day, or maybe Les Paul was playing around and experimenting. And the line you draw from somebody taking that random happenstance in the studio to today's pedal market, where there are thousands of different flanger pedals out there that each have their unique spin on it, is a story that's so musical and so human and so historically compelling to me that that's a lot of the motivation behind this film. But also, I mean, a lot of what we do at Reverb more generally, I think. But where I really get excited is in talking to all the people who make these flanger pedals or whatever kind of pedal, is that every single version of it, even though they all ostensibly do the same thing, has a certain amount of personality baked into it. Mm-hmm. When people are buying those flanger pedals or deciding which pedal they're going to buy, there's a lot of the same way that, you know, if you go to a record store, the rock records are all rock records, but they all are different. They all have a style and a vibe and an aesthetic and artistic choices that go into them. And that line between these pedals being tools to create a certain sound versus them expressing something that a builder was trying to do and then that you can then in turn use to express what you want to do. It's just so much intersection of technology and art and music that it's really joyful. And it's a really joyful story that we're trying to tell here that kind of reflects all of that.
What can you talk about some of the experiences you've had in making the movie? You already said you had like 75 hours or so of recorded footage. You've had to have had some interesting conversations and interesting things happen while you're filming this thing. Can you talk about some of those?
Sure. I'm trying to think which comes to mind first.
There's been so many. And obviously without giving too much away, because, you know,
right, exactly.
It's going to be in there.
Yeah.
But I think one of the great things really has been to actually spend time going to spend time actually at the places where some of these OG like 90s builders, mm-hmm. the boutique guys like Mike Pereira and Zach Vex and people like that, Mike Fuller, being able to actually go to them and be in their space and in their world. And these are people that we all looked up to since we were first playing guitar. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to kind of go inside of their space and get some of that perspective has been really, really phenomenal. They're trading a lot of stories. You know, the folks who were around in those early days of the boutique industry are trading stories about each other. And it's so interesting to hear stories about George Tripps when he's 16 or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think those have been the really interesting things.
I think something else that's been really interesting is, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And a lot of these stories that we're hearing, what I mean by that is that, okay, in the 70s, they didn't have the internet, but there were still people making pedal companies mm-hmm. out of their basements the way that people were doing it today or were doing it in the 90s. And the time and place and the technology and the kind of industry changes. But there's this common thread between all. I mean, I'm sure you've experienced a lot of this yourself in the interviews you've done for the podcast where it's like, a lot of people are coming at it from a place of passion and a hobby. And then the sort of slow transformation from, I'm going to fix this pedal for my friend. I'm going to build this pedal for my friend. I'm going to build 10 of these for the shop down the street to being a company with 30 employees manufacturing thousands of pedals a year. That, you know, there's different variations on that theme. But in every single case, people get into this business from a place of real passion and joy. And it's just been really interesting to hear all the different kind of permutations of that storyline told from across decades and across countries and across all kinds of other barriers. That's not a specific story, but it's a theme that's been really exciting to learn about.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I mean, you know, I've obviously gotten close with Brian Wampler because we do the Chasing Tone podcast together. Excuse me. But he was the first guy in the business that I got really close to because of that. For whatever reason, he came on. I mean, when he came on my show, we just hit the right vibe. I don't know why. Like, we just we hit it off. And some guys, you know, literally everyone that's been on my show has been awesome. But some people, you know, you just connect with a little bit better for no real reason whatsoever. So when he asked me to do the podcast with him because he was considering shutting it down, I was like, well, we'll just try a couple, you know, and see what happens. And here, I think I've done as many Chasing Tone episodes or more at this point than I have of my own show. And it's amazing to me that people still listen after all this time. But where I was going with that is like hearing Brian tell some stories from, you know, because he was obviously in it way before I was. It's like, it's just funny to hear like him talk about like back in the day, the Wampler v. Keeley things and the forums and stuff. And then now these two are just hanging out at NAMM. Like, what were we even doing?
Right.
Like, it's
right.
Really fascinating. But
yeah, I think that's the thing that's come up a lot is like, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but like how, you know, there are exceptions, but a lot of people, the way people approach competition in this industry is very novel to me. It's very like high tide raises all ships. Everybody, it seems like everybody really wants their competitors to succeed in a lot of ways. So if you think back to, I mean, maybe it was different when Wampler in the early days, but you know, I think everybody here is sort of, they're all friends. They all have a lot of mm-hmm. common ground. They all, you know, hang out at NAMM or wherever else. And it's hard to think of a lot of other industries where there's like that level of kind of co-support that exists. Something that an analogy that a lot of people we've interviewed have drawn is like the punk rock scene, where it's like, okay, yeah, I'm selling a 7-inch vinyl, and like maybe the band across down the street is also selling a 7-inch vinyl, but we're still playing shows together and we're still supporting each other, and it's a scene, and like that sort of sense of like music scene and community, it filters into this industry in a way that's like very very palpable.
You also see that a lot in collaborations, which is something that really didn't exist too much, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And now you see so many builders teaming up to do really interesting things. And Joel Corte from Chase Bliss, you know, he was a little weary when he did that first collaboration. Afterwards, he was like, I just want to do more and more and more of these. It was a, you know, he was a changed man. So there's things like that you see when talking to, you know, Felipe from Caroline or any of these folks who like to, you know, get feedback or team up with other builders. It's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten lucky enough. I've done, I don't even remember, 5 or 6 different collabs through the podcast with some companies. And I'm like, this is kind of unique. You don't see this kind of thing very often. It's, right. You know, I'm like, you know, it's just kind of like, I have an idea, but I don't build stuff. You know, I've always been like this guy. I'm like, I know I could build like a simple fuzz pedal or, you know, a tube screamer or something. Like, I have the abilities to do that, but I'm more interested in letting the guys do it that really know what they're doing. Cause I want to play them. I know just enough about electronics to be dangerous. And so it's just like, let the pros go. But like, I have all weird ideas all the time that might stem from any number of places, but like some of these guys are like, yeah, let's run with it. I'm like, really? Oh, okay. All right. It's a lot for me to absorb sometimes because I'm just like, I'm just a mechanic here. Right. Like I never intended to, like, when I first started my career, get into the industry, but then I realized I wanted to and was able to force my way in this weird way that I didn't expect to work quite as well as it did.
Yeah. And that's kind of a fascinating thing that mirrors the building industry itself. You kind of have a few different schools. You have the folks who really grew up as engineers, and whether they wanted to work on radios or they wanted to work for, you know, whatever it is, whatever their aspirations were, that, you know, they got those degrees. And then there's the other half, which sort of fell into it by accident, really, or just by tinkering, but have no background. And though those are different paths to the same result, because of that, you see such a difference in how people think about their companies and their brands in general, and how, you know, how they market everything. It kind of goes into everything. You see a lot of personality come through those different variations.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously pedals are a big deal for reverb in many different ways, you know, from the initial launches that you guys sometimes help companies with, you know, the marketing support or just the constant reselling that goes on there. Like, they're important to the company, but like I was asked this question the other day, like, do you think that the pedal market sells more than, like, more pedals than the guitar market? And I'm like, no, it can't. But then I got to thinking about the secondary market and I'm like, well, from a dollar perspective, maybe. But I guess where I'm going with that is like, have pedals become as important as guitars as they are as the guitar itself? Do you guys think that, or what's your theories?
I think it varies quite a bit depending on the type. I think it's not, I don't want to say dangerous because the stakes are so low, but it's slippery to like think of guitar playing monolithically, right? Like, you have, and I hate to be generational about these things, but I think there is a certain generational divide that exists here. Where like maybe the older school is really interested in amassing guitars. Not that you're not interested in amassing guitars, as I can see by the room we're sitting in, or you can see in my house also. but you know, I think there's a younger class that, you know, thinks of pedals as a more standalone entity, and is sort of the ends in and of itself. Whereas maybe the older school is sort of like, pedals are maybe what they were conventionally thought of, which is enhancements, and the guitar and the amp is first. Something that's come up in a lot of interviews with Josh Scott and Philippe from Caroline put it really, really well, because he's got a very interesting business perspective on a lot of this stuff, is 2008 and the recession being this huge turning point for pedals, because at the time, people are a little bit more cash strapped. They still want to have their hobby be exciting and change things up, but maybe they can't put out the, you know, high dollar amounts for a new amp or a new guitar, but they can buy a pedal and change things up and have some fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easier to hide that in a credit card statement and, or, you know, or they can resell it or whatever and kind of, and
scratch the itch.
So their theory is that the kind of like the recession era, sort of ignited the pedal industry in a lot of ways, which happened to coincide with a lot of the pedal companies that we think of as kind of the bread and butter, and it's a loaded term, but like boutique, you know, pedals. And by which I mean like, you know, Earthquaker, JHS, mm-hmm. Wampler, Keeley. That's sort of all when they were kind of starting up was that same time frame. And ironically, the kind of global business contraction shifted buying habits to a lower price bracket, and that really fueled pedals. I don't know if this is really answering your question, but I think it's interesting because like that mentality of like, I can do this thing that's cheaper and constantly evolving, buy this, try it for a little bit, flip it. Maybe I keep it. Maybe I sell it. Maybe I mod it. And that excitement of the chase is sort of, I think, where a lot of this comes from.
And the other kind of completely bonkers aspect to this entire thing is the new notion of pedals being used by people who don't really play guitar or don't consider themselves guitar players, but more so tinkers, noise makers, ambient artists, which are totally valid in their own right. But, you know, I think the modern pedal market, when you have companies like Alexander and Empress and, you know, making things that are an hologram, you know, companies like this, they're feeding into a whole different type of musician, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it, even though these effects can be so kind of like verbose and kind of big and knobby, it actually makes it more accessible to some people who don't necessarily know how to make traditional music,
yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole other interesting thing that we're exploring as well.
That is interesting. I didn't really think about that, but excuse me. The first time I remember really considering that guitar pedals could be used for non-guitar things. You know, I'm sure I heard about some musician using them on vocals or something at some point, but the time that really kind of like kicked my brain is when I interviewed Brian from Small Sound Big Sound. Yeah. And he's like, well, I was asking him some guitar stuff. And he's like, well, I don't really play guitar. I'm like, wait a minute. You build it like my, I don't know. I'd have to go listen to the interview again to know how I responded. But I was like, what?
Right. So he was the keyboardist in Simple Z Guitar.
Yeah, still is.
I think they actually just broke up.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Don't quote me on that because I don't want to speak out of school here. But I've actually interviewed them before.
And okay.
For the record, their records mm-hmm. sound excellent.
Yes.
And they have really cool sonic textures on them. And it's really, when I interviewed them, it's like he makes pedals that, you know, the other members of the band can then add to their setups like on the fly. There's a lot of like customizations going on, and he plays synths and approaches his pedals very much from that kind of perspective, which is, it's really interesting. I mean, there's a lot of examples of that. I mean, we interviewed Maris, as you have as well, the Maris guys for this this film, and you know, they come at it from a very like democratic synth guitar, whatever. The pedals are the pedals, whatever you want to do with it is fine. That's one example. I mean, Strymon pedals. And I think more and more brands also, but Strymon pedals, you know, automatically switch from instrument to line level to accommodate whatever you want to plug into them. Like there's an awareness just even on like a utilitarian level of that broadening of the pedal horizon that I think is happening very widely.
You just made something click in my brain when we were doing the interview. I didn't mention Strymon at all, and that was really dumb.
Oh, it's okay. We interviewed them. we went to their facility in somewhere north of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating. We interviewed the three you know the founders who were there, and they have really interesting backgrounds. You know, I think one of them used to work for like Boeing. Interesting footnote to that, which has come up in a lot of interviews. A lot of people who have started pedal companies have worked at Line 6.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's a strange thing where Line 6 is like this sort of, I mean, there's a lot of Line 6 fan people. I can tell you quite definitively that there's a lot of Line 6 gear that gets sold on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you don't typically think of Line 6 when you think of like cool groundbreaking pedals. But I mean, who hasn't had a DL4 on their board, right? The DL4 is still being made in this exact same way it's been made for the last 18 years. And it's like a revolutionary effect in so many ways. But I don't know. Maybe it doesn't get the street cred that, you know, a cool like an Earthquaker or like Chase Bliss pedal does.
I think you also have to look at timeline. You know, when Line 6 was really starting to pop, it was in that time where you started to see a lot of these folks who went on to create other companies just beginning in the industry. I think Line 6, from what we've heard, was very welcoming and open to these people. Obviously, these folks were talented enough to go and end up doing their own thing. So I think Line 6, you know, whether it was George Tripp's deciding to go do stuff there, or you know, or some of the other folks,
Maris,
right?
Yeah, Maris.
You know,
Sam Strymon. You know,
yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And they described Line 6 as being this very sort of like entrepreneurial atmosphere back in the day, where like the people who were running the ship, whose name escaped me unfortunately, were like just really good at like mentoring the younger engineers. So I think they kind of instilled in them the sense that like, yeah, you too can go make a product on your own. And that's like it's sort of like, you know, if you look at like the classic Miles Davis ensembles from like the 50s and stuff, like everybody in that went on to start their own band. It was sort of right. Like school, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, I don't know, like John Coltrane, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of this other kind of like, you know, academy of like music engineering that existed.
Yeah. I mean, and Strymon's a you know, I remember I talked to Pete about this, and the Maris Strymon connection's like interesting. And I don't know how many people actually know that those are related. They're not related, but they have a lineage that is very similar. And I think a lot of that has to do with like Line 6 must have hired just like really smart engineers, you know, clearly mm-hmm. from what they've been able to do with, I mean, we laugh at it, but the old Line 6 Spider 2, especially for its day. I mean, like that is an impressive piece of technology. Like, it's funny to laugh at and make and poke fun but it's impressive.
I would not even for a minute, you know, diminish the sort of influence and like quality of the Line 6 stuff out there. I'll give you the best example. My dad plays guitar, and my dad's not interested in amassing a pedal board. He hasn't got time for that. It's like, you know, like I was saying, generationally, I don't think he connects like that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he's given me feedback on like Reverb emails he gets, where he's like, you know, you open your emails just to see what you guys are doing, but like, I just don't know why there's all these different pedals out there. And it's like, all right, cool, Dad, no problem. You know, you keep playing your 60 Strat. But you know, for his birthday, I got him a Line 6 M9, which is, mm-hmm. you know, a pretty great but relatively, you know, straightforward multi-effect.
Yeah.
He's totally happy. He doesn't need that. I think it's really, and this is something we owe, I mean, like, just to pull the curtain back on Reverb marketing a little bit, like, we always have to be checking ourselves about, which is like, it's so easy to play to the gearheads, the forum people, and like the people who are on YouTube and Instagram obsessing over this stuff, because that's like who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really easy to like market to yourself. and you know, that's authenticity. Like, we're trying to do that to a certain degree, but it's really easy to lose sight of the fact that like you know, a lot of people who play guitar out there don't need that much sophisticated gear. They need the bread and butter stuff. And like, that's 100% valid and should be celebrated, you know, as much as the people with, you know, a closet full of pedals or whatever it is.
Yeah, but at the same time, they've been marketed to for like 60 years, so it's our turn.
Sure. all of the above. It's not mutually exclusive.
No, I mean, that is actually something that I struggle with as a gearhead and a guy who, you know, helps companies try to market this stuff. I'm like my dad comes over and he's like, what is all of this? Kind of the same thing. He's a guitar player too, but you know, it's not the same. He doesn't do the same thing that I do. He just doesn't have the interest or the time to get into it like I did. And it's interesting because I think because there are so many gearheads now and people involved at the consumer level, I think that that's just becoming less of a thing. And maybe I have my blinders on to it, but I think more and more people are like, yeah, pedals are cool. Like, I don't hear that much straight into the amp anymore. It could be, you know, self-selecting because of the circles I run in, but I don't hear anybody say that with like a straight face, like pedals suck, going straight into the amp. I haven't heard that seriously in quite some time.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
Even our pal Joe Bonamassa owns Tube Screamers.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. He has his own signature pedal. Look at that. Right.
A couple, I think, yeah. yeah. So yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I will say, and this is more of a reflection on my shortcomings than anything, I know a lot more about gear than my dad does. I mean, obviously I do it for a living. My dad spends a lot more time looking at tabs and actually learning how to play guitar parts.
Mm-hmm. I haven't done that for years. There's no reason for that now. No reason to get started. No, that makes, and I think it is a generational thing. There's no other way to put it. Like people, yeah, I don't know where the cutoff is exactly, but you know, 45 and younger tend to maybe be more interested in effects. And I think that has entirely to do with the artist we came up listening to.
Totally.
A lot of us came out of the Warped Tour punk thing, and there was all kinds of crazy bands making all kinds of crazy noises and all kinds of different ways back then. I think that left an impression on our generation that's bigger than maybe what some people realize.
Yeah.
That era is kind of easy to poke fun at, like, oh, all these emo kids and blah, 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 wristband rock or whatever. But like all of those bands are now like coming back and doing 10, 15 year tours, and they're selling out. Like, I think that people our age, I think that fueled a lot of that. And that kind of more rebellious, you know, our rock stars were not rock stars as right. much as our parents' rock stars were.
Right. I mean, sense. I think my approach to it, I went to Warped Tour once or twice, but less like that, like strand of punk. For me, it was like, you know, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, grunge. Mm-hmm. And that led me down the path to like Husker Du, Fugazi, and Dinosaur Jr. And Dinosaur Jr. Is sort of this branch out into like this vast world of like the, I would say maybe like the first generation of pedal first rock music, I guess. Mm-hmm. Which is like obviously like shoegaze is sort of part of that, and then everything that's followed. And I'm not saying that my musical tastes or influence are particularly noteworthy, but I feel like there's a lot of people in our generation who came up with that kind of like alt rock, indie rock,
yeah,
and various things that have come out of punk that have been sort of expanded by virtue of a lot of noise. Mm-hmm. And how do you get a lot of noise? You use a lot of pedals.
Mm-hmm.
And Jay, you know, we're on a first name basis now.
Oh, just kidding. I love it. Send me his number.
I'll tell you a funny side story about Jay Masses if you want.
Okay, go for it.
Jay Masses came to film a video with us once, and it was the same week. We do quizzes on Reverb sometime. Maybe mm-hmm. you've taken a couple. And one of the quizzes I made once was called What can we guess what kind of guitar you play? The most like silly, you know, internet froth you can imagine, right? And the way it was calculated was I just asked like, you know, how many guitars do you have? Like, what kind of music do you play?
I took this quiz. I remember. Yes.
And, you know, obviously it's not going to get everybody right. It's not the point. It's a fun thing to do on a Sunday morning when we send out the email or whatever. And a lot of people commented and said, wow, I can't believe you got it right. Jay Masses, perhaps the most iconic jazz master player in the world,
mm-hmm.
was filming a video with us that week, and we were chatting about it afterwards. He was playing Riot Fest in Chicago that night, and he was just like, yeah, man, I took this quiz on your site this week, and it said I played Paul Reed Smith. And I'm like a Dinosaur Jr. diehard, and mm-hmm. like, I don't think I've ever been more embarrassed of anything that's ever happened in my life. Like, that was like a heartbreak, you know?
Like, hey, I'm not a software engineer, okay? I'm just trying my best over yeah. here, Jay.
Gotta recheck that algorithm.
But the thing is, if you think about it, I don't know how old he is, but he's like, and he probably answered on the quiz that he has 50 guitars or something. So the math of it is like, okay, if you have that many guitars and you're of like a certain age bracket, then like, okay, maybe you like Paul Reed Smith. Like, that's sort of how it was calculated.
I'm trying to remember if it got me right or not.
We'll have to take it again.
I'll have to try it again. I feel like I remember being like, yeah, that's pretty close. Thing like, I got a Jazzmaster or a Les Paul or something.
The thing about
like,
it is right. When you have enough guitars, it's always going to be right, right?
This is a good point.
So, you know, people who are most sensitive to this, it's like, you know, it kind of has a get out of jail free card.
Well, yeah, but if you would have said Strat, I would have been like, hey, what's going on here?
Because sure.
There isn't
yeah, no Strat.
I don't see no Strat, Strats.
Yeah.
Not because I like hate them. They're just not one that's ever like, I mean, on the internet, I'll pretend to hate them, but I don't actually hate them.
I think Strats are back, man. I mean, I consider myself like a little bit more observer and referee than having a real horse in this race. But mm-hmm. like, you know, I go to like South by Southwest or wherever, and you go to see all like the hip up and coming bands, and like it's all white strats with maple necks and maple fretboards, you know. There's, I mean, just keep an eye out for it. Like that's definitely an aesthetic that's like very present right now, I think. We just did a video with Mac DeMarco. Uh-huh. Who I think people sometimes say, oh, he's very influential in like the youthful gear culture.
Oh yeah. Big yeah. time. And I can totally see him, you know, why he's playing that kind of strats. Cause he's so hard trying to look like a dad.
Yeah, totally.
And so of course he's going to play a white strat with
the maybe it's the Wayne's World thing, white strat.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to say anything bad about a white strat. I'll be honest. I prefer a rosewood fretboard, but
sure.
If I was going to get a strat, it would be white or black, probably.
Yeah. White strat. Thanks, Albert Hammond Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That too.
Random, since you were telling a Jay story, I don't have a Jay story, but Jay is the reason that I have a cabinet with glass fronts for my pedals. I seen him in that, well, strange, weird way to connect it, the documentary Fuzz that came out, 6 years ago, maybe? Something like that? I remember seeing Jay with this Curio cabinet of Big Muffs behind him, and I was like, I need that. And so I got that cabinet, I can put shelves in it.
He's even like influential on a furniture basis.
Exactly. Amazing. He's a force of nature. You can't argue with the Jay Maskus influence. He's amazing.
Yeah.
Great. So let's talk about reverb specifically a little bit.
Sure.
So since you guys have both been there since basically, for all intents and purposes, day one.
Yeah.
So like it's reverb in the short time that it's been around has been a massive influence on the gear community. And when I first heard about it, I was like, so it's eBay for music gear. I'm like, okay, like, don't we already have eBay though? And slowly over time, you guys have totally done a way better job than eBay serving this community and making it easy. I mean, I just listed a drill on eBay the other day and I was like, they need to take some lessons from Reverb. This is a pain, you know, like, so what do you think was like, where did that come from? Like, what was the process behind, like,
sure.
Because like I said, the pitch wasn't selling me. It was the execution that sold me.
I can tell you the origin story a little bit and kind of work from there. I mean, it's been said in other interviews and stuff, but the short version is that David, our founder, who, you know, I think we would both count as a mentor of sort, you know, he's the CEO and founder of the company. So he has a lot of influence, you know, in the operations over the years. And, you know, it's been a huge impact on my life anyway. He had a lot of success earlier in life in some other industries and got into the guitar business from a place of genuine passion and interest, you know. And, you know, it's no secret he bought Chicago Music Exchange. Have you ever been to Chicago Music Exchange?
No, unfortunately. It's a bucket list thing for me.
Well, we'll have to come by sometime. It's a really amazing store. And, you know, he was really frustrated trying to sell guitars online. And eBay being just one example of where that frustration came from, I think it's safe to say.
Mm-hmm.
So because he had some experience in the tech world building platforms, it was that simple. I could just make another website for selling stuff. And since he kind of had his network in the vintage guitar world, early on, vintage guitars were really where we first made an impact. So in the early days, this meant going to like the Arlington Guitar Show down in Texas, one of the big, you know, vintage guitar shows. Really leveraging our networks and, you know, having a lot of phone calls with vintage guitar dealers and of all sizes, whether they were shops like Chicago Music Exchange or, you know, individuals who just trafficked in guitars, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what we sort of got the ball rolling. But since day one, I mean, where I think we've had success and continue to have success is by being very attuned to that community. Originally it was vintage guitars, soon became pedals, obviously. And then, you know, today we do a lot with synthesizers, microphones, trumpets. I mean, you name it. If it makes music, I mean, people are buying and selling it on Reverb. And where I think we've been, the reason that I think that's continued to expand is that most of the people who work at the company play music in some capacity or another. And that's not just the people like us who are making, you know, articles or videos and have to have a certain amount of knowledge. It means people who are writing code for our, you know, iOS app, or people who are doing accounting. I mean, it's everybody in the company has an appreciation of what it means to be a musician with a budget, trying to get the gear that they want and kind of operating in that space. And I think that informs pretty much every decision that happens at the company. So that, so what you're saying, the differentiation between other platforms out there comes from a place of like, I really think just sort of authentic experience and being able to identify, this is what I would want out of trying to figure out how much my guitar is worth or making a listing for my pedal or microphone or whatever it is. Oh, cool. I've always wished that we had something that would do this or something that would do that. And it's sort of that lived experience combined with being very attuned to listening to our customers and users of the site has been, I would say, the guiding principle of the company since it's existed.
Mm-hmm. So like, it seems like a lot of it is like he kind of realized the same thing that everybody did. Like there's no real seamless way, modern way, mm-hmm. you know, with these wonderful smartphones we're carrying around in our pockets all the time. Like eBay's still clunky, you know, yeah. if that's just one example, just because I just have a recent experience with it.
Sure.
And I haven't done a ton of selling on Reverb because I don't sell anything, but I have sold a couple like collabs and stuff. Yeah. I was like, well, let's put it on Reverb. Why not? And I'm like, wow, that was easy. You know, I think that's a lot of it. So I think that shows is what yeah. I'm getting at. It shows that like, oh, they made this simpler for us. Maybe it's because they know us musicians aren't that smart. I don't know. But
yeah, that's exactly what it is.
So, yeah, that's really interesting. So did you see from an early stage, did you think that not that it's over, because this is in some ways just the beginning, that the acquisition was kind of like a purpose? Like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, was Reverb going there from day one, or was that something that just kind of happened as a result of doing your job really well?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it wasn't really necessarily the goal, which, you know, I don't mean this critically by any stretch of the imagination, but a lot of tech companies, just reality of like the startup culture, start their companies with the intention of getting acquired.
Yep.
Really wasn't our playbook. I mean, we obviously it was always a possibility, but it was more like our goal is to make a company that's sustainable and a company that serves our clients as well as possible and offers a service that they can appreciate and rely on and they feel good about using. And, you know, if that leads to other opportunities or successes, that's sort of like the next step. With the acquisition that happened this year, you know, it's really great. Like there are just the reality situation is with tech companies, there's a lot of boring stuff that happens behind the scenes.
I'm sure.
And having a sort of bigger brother partner in Etsy that has been able to provide us with a lot of excellent guidance and sort of advice because they've, you know, they're an older company. It's a different industry, but although there are a lot of music people on Etsy, believe it or not.
There are, yeah.
So they face similar challenges, whether that means, you know, shipping labels or credit card processing or, you know, staffing or whatever it is, just challenges of scaling a business like this that, you know, any company is going to face when it grows. Having that kind of extra resource in our corner is really, I think, where the appeal of this partnership and acquisition came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think it's, you guys are making a movie, so obviously the direction as far as the media side of it isn't really going to change, it doesn't sound like. In fact, it may even get better.
Yeah, I think so.
More resources, you know, things like that.
And if you notice some of the things we've been doing recently, such as the Why Does Motown Sound Like Motown piece, or, you know, these various documentaries that we've been doing, mm-hmm. you know, the goal is for us to highlight some extremely interesting things to us that we think are kind of big, interesting, educational and inspirational projects for all musicians. So I think the pedal movie definitely represents that as well.
Yeah, I think Michael really hit it on the head. I mean, if you go to our YouTube channel and kind of scroll back, you'll see that we've been trying to focus on things that are like, I don't know. I think there comes a point where like your standard issue demo, there's a lot of people doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we have the ability or resources or I don't know, just kind of honestly just want internally to branch out. And the pedal movie is the biggest example of that.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to work for a company where that's not questioned. There's not an environment where, you know, there's a lot of it's you know, we're in a position where we can function and still let our kind of creative vision and kind of inspiration guide a lot of the decision making. And that's really not something that I take for granted. And it's really awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I could see in another entity like this getting totally meddled with.
Right.
Like, no, 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 don't say that. We have a relationship with this pedal company, so don't let that guy say something bad about Line 6, you know, or whatever.
It's funny you mention it, because this is sort of a joke, but also not really a joke. I wish there was more, like, bad mouthing. I mean, that came out a little bit harsher than I meant it to, but, like, people in the pedal community are so cool and so friendly with each other, and they do it from such a place of, like, you know, wonder and like, enjoyment that, like, you know, nobody, very few people have said anything bad about. I mean, the only stuff that comes up as bad is people get frustrated with, like, you know, forum trolls. And mm-hmm. like, it's not like any, there's been, I can't even think of a single example where somebody's been like, I won't, you know, you watch out because this dude crossed me and made this pedal that was that. Like, it's just like not really. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of that people don't want to talk about, but it might not be that interesting of a story. There's no conflict.
Yeah, I mean, there is conflict, but it's generally handled sort of like, how should I say this? I've seen and experienced conflict that's happened in this industry. So Totally. Despite it being happy-go-lucky for the most part, I feel like in a weird way it gets resolved in almost internally, like a big corporation. Totally. Like HR steps in, and it really just consists of two dudes calling each other and being like kissing and making up, right. Basically, you know? Right.
And the real conflict that is in the story, I mean, now that I pause to think about that statement, is obviously one of, like, the fact that this boutique industry making this relatively niche piece of technology can support hundreds of people, you know, thousands of people, and have livelihoods. Like, the conflict of, like, the pedal world versus, like, the realities of the economy and society and overcoming that. That's the actual conflict at play here.
There's also, we also explore certain cultural and personal conflicts. But, you know, overall, it is a piece that I think is going to celebrate the history and the lineage, almost like something that's a chronological look at how this entire thing went from a few builders, a few people making a couple things, to thousands and thousands in this massively bolstered and supported industry. So that takes a lot of time. There's a lot of conflict, actually, that goes into that, from, you know, EHX and MXR going under to, you know, there's plenty of examples within the history of this. It spans, you know, over half a century and hundreds of people. So,
yeah, I just want to get Mike Matthews on this show so I can talk to him about the Russian mafia. That's what I want
to
do.
Yeah. Also, I hate to even describe it, because I'm not going to get the details right, but I was researching this in our lead up to interviewing him, and I found this old magazine article interview with him where he talked about, like, the reason EHX went under in the early 80s had to do with, like union corruption in New York City.
I remember reading the same thing. I don't know where I found it.
It's crazy. And then the reason he got into, like, Russia and the soft tech era was that he was importing military tubes from Soviet Russia to the U.S. He was the first person to do that. Mm-hmm. And that led to Russian manufacturing. I mean, the guy's like, I mean, he's such a legend. He's had an insane story. It's amazing.
And for the rest of that story, watch the pedal movie.
Yeah, stay tuned.
All right, so before we get into the last couple of questions, let's plug this thing a little bit, even though we can't totally plug it. Roughly, when's this coming out? And how are you planning on putting it out, if you can say that?
So it'll be out in 2020. Mm-hmm. Still TBD. There's a lot of details to work out. But you'll definitely know that it's coming out when it does. There'll be plenty of time. There'll be a release date. So... the goal is that, yeah, it'll be out to streaming, you know, on your television, on your computer, on your phone, however you want to view it, sometime in 2020, and that we can confidently say.
All right, that sounds good. I like
and,
that.
And you can also follow us on Instagram at the pedal movie.
There you go. Perfect. All right, since we're talking about pedals, and this seems very appropriate considering my hat, what do you guys think are the best Boss pedals?
The best Boss pedals.
Your favorite Boss pedal is actually how I usually phrase that.
That's a really good question. I would say the one that's had the biggest influence on my experience as a guitar player is the RV5 Reverb. Mm. And it's not like one that's in the Hall of Fame of, like, the go-to Boss pedals necessarily, but when I was first learning about pedals and I was in a noise rock band in college, my co-guitarist Mike was sort of like my Yoda, my tone Yoda. And he recommended that one. Flash forward to a few years ago, and I had another, I had a spring based reverb pedal. It was the sort of like your standard issue Bolton Brick, I think it is, like the really kit based spring pedal. I just bought like a cheap one on Reverb. And I was like, I really like the spring reverb as the always on reverb, but I really like the crazy modulation setting on the RV5, like maxed out for like the freak out shoegaze moments. So I had this guy, Noise Kick Effects, he's a reverb seller based out of Baltimore, make a custom pedal for me, which on one side was just the simple standard 3-knob Bolton Brick spring reverb. On the other side was a rehoused RV5.
Cool.
So you, and it has an effects loop in it. So what that means, obviously, is that you can have the spring emulation on all the time. The freak out shoegaze setting on the boss pedal on your second button, and then everything else from delay, overdrive, whatever else you want can go through the effects loop. So it's all being reverberated through that one input.
Sweet.
So that's my very roundabout way to say the RV5 reverb.
All right. Good answer.
I grew up a child of 80s and 90s new wave and Britpop. So it's pretty easy to say that I love the OD2. I had that. That was one of the first pedals I ever had. And a lot of those folks use that. But also the Dimension C. Mm-hmm. I found a Dimension C 10 years ago at a garage sale for $5.
Nice.
I sold it on Reverb for considerably more.
You should also mention, you also have that multi effect.
Oh, currently. The MS-3.
So another plug for you. Michael and I are in a country band together.
What?
In Chicago.
What?
Called the Cattle Catchers. Because we don't spend enough time together at work and making this movie. We also needed to be in a band together. Mm-hmm. We've only played one show, so it's not that exciting. we did practice last night. But if you're ever in Chicago, just look up every venue in the city and see if the Cattle Catchers happen to be playing.
Exactly.
But for that, you use, what is it, the MS-3?
The MS-3, which is this great product that's sort of, I never thought I'd be a multi-effect person, but how they made this is just extremely convenient when you're doing fly dates or when you're running around and you only need a couple of things. In a country band, I need a slapback, I need a compressor, and I need a tremolo. That's just for me. And so, you know, I can stuff that in a gig bag, run off with it. I can also hook up other things to it. It's a great little product.
It's a cool little thing because it has effects loops in it. So it's like this multi-effect that is built to accommodate outboard like analog pedals as part
of it. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like, it's like a, I heard Matt Knight from Boss. He has a podcast. You guys might know Guitar Nerds.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
He was talking about, because people, the thing that I was so excited about the MS-3 when it came out, I was like, perfect. That's what I need. Because I was considering the ES-8 and ES-5. But then I found out you couldn't move the effects block of the MS-3 around like you could on the ES series. You can change the order of any loop on the ES series without unplugging things. Which I was like, oh, that's going to be so cool. Right. Can't do that on the MS-3, but the reason why is because of the addition of that digital effect. That has to remain where it is. So they didn't allow that. It just doesn't work if they move that around. So
right.
So I thought that was interesting. But that sounds like a really cool little pedal.
It is. I mean, I have my massive pedal board and everything like that. But it's just really
got to maintain the credibility here.
Well, yeah.
What's your favorite Boss pedal?
My favorite Boss pedal, it changes a lot. But it's probably going to be the BF2 right now. Oh. I really like the flanger. I have an old made in Japan one that I'm like, man, this thing just sounds good. No matter where I put it, it sounds cool.
Have you been to Minneapolis recently?
I've never been to Minneapolis.
It's a great town. Highly recommend it. I was there about a year ago and I went to Paisley Park, which has been converted into like the Prince Museum.
Okay.
Two different parts of the Paisley Park tour. Like his main studio. He had three studios in the building. And then he also has this giant sound stage. It's kind of surreal. You're going to this like building and like you go out to the back and there's like a airplane hangar size soundstage.
Sweet.
But at both the soundstage and one of his studios, they have two of Prince's pedal boards. And not surprisingly, 100% Boss.
Oh, yeah. I believe that. I definitely believe that. I think, in fact, you know what? I'm pretty sure I've seen pictures of it before. Yeah. And he's been brought up before as like the quote unquote anti-boutique.
Right.
Well, Prince only used Boss pedals. I'm like, well, you know what? Boss pedals are good. I don't know when did we get into this thing that Boss pedals aren't good?
Right.
You know?
I mean, this came up when we were talking to Josh Scott. It's like, like the pedal industry exists because of boss pedals. I mean, you mentioned it earlier too. It's not even really a controversial take.
Nope.
You know, it's like there's a lot of cool stuff out there, but like, you know, deference where it's due, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right, guys. Here's the final question for you. What kind of pizza do you like?
Ooh, we had some pizza last night. My cat kept on trying to eat it because he's a real, real gluttonous little beggar of a cat. He's like Garfield, but, you know, not orange. we're both Chicago people, mm-hmm. so we'll go ahead and say very boldly, deep dish is not pizza.
No, it is not.
Well, okay. Wow. People, this is not what I was expecting.
This is the inside line. Deep dish is a tourist thing. You know, it's like going, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of examples in every town. Like, would you go to Voodoo Donuts?
Probably not anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I only eat deep dish when I have relatives or something from out of town who really want to order it. But it's just after a certain point, it's just like, why would you do that to yourself? It's like, if you're going to eat lasagna, eat lasagna.
There's another kind of Chicago pizza that people don't talk as much about because not quite as fun, but it is definitely as delicious, which is the more thin style Chicago pizza.
We're starting to get more like New York style pizza shops in Chicago that are making the kind of like bigger, thinner crust style mm-hmm. to varying degrees of success, I would say. But I mean, to me, the pizza average in Chicago pales in comparison to anywhere in the Upper East Coast.
Oh, interesting.
That being said, if you must have deep dish pizza, go to Pequod's.
Pequod's is good.
That is the only place you should go. Eat at Pequod's.
Yeah.
They're not paying me to say that.
Okay.
And spinach is the best topping or filling for deep dish. If you're a meat eater, sausage and spinach is the classic.
Okay.
But again, I would say if you're visiting Chicago, go to Pequod's. Don't go to Giordano's or I mean, you can. They're all the same. But and if you're going to just want to have the experience of deep dish, do the spinach or sausage and spinach if you eat meat.
All right. That didn't answer my question.
Oh, what kind of pizza do we like?
Yeah,
I like mushroom pizza.
Okay, like thin crust.
There's a place in Chicago called Dante's, which is like an East Coast style kind of place. Mm-hmm. Bigger. And my favorite pizza you get from there is that they have both portobellas and non-portobello mushrooms. Mm. It doesn't say what the second type of mushroom is. It just says mushroom. So if you get the pizza that has both type of mushrooms on it, it's like this umami bomb. And I love that.
My Italian grandmother would probably throw a shoe at me, but I'm going to honestly be controversial and say I love Hawaiian pizza. Nah, I said it.
Somebody was going to say it. I knew somebody was going to say it.
Well, there's also that pedal, the Carolina.
I love Carolina
pizza.
I love
and he Hawaiian said he pizza. Named it Hawaiian pizza because you either love it or you hate it.
I feel like he did it just to irritate me.
I love Hawaiian pizza. We should get some Hawaiian pizza.
Let's do that.
We had pizza last night.
I mean,
night.
I don't know why anyone would do that to themselves, but I guess, you know, to each their own. Sure. No, I'm not a pineapple fan, just in general. So
yeah.
But I don't know, if you like it, you like it. It's all that matters.
Just like tone, my friend.
Exactly. Yeah. Just like tone. All right. Would you guys have anything you'd like to leave the people with before we take off here?
I would just say, you know, if you've listened this far and you're somebody who cares about music gear, if you've used Reverb to buy or sell at any point over the last 7 years or however long, like, thank you. We really, really appreciate it. Yeah. And Reverb doesn't exist without musicians and music makers and music inclined people trying to get cool gear and do cool stuff. So really genuinely, thank you to whoever might be listening.
All right. Sounds good. Also, you should use tonemob.com/reverb. If you're going to buy anything off of Reverb, there's your commercial.
By all means.
Thank you guys for that, by the way. All right. Let's wrap this thing up. For Dan and Michael, this is Blake. And as always, folks, good luck and good tone. All right, there you have it. There's another one in the can. So make sure you follow The Pedal Movie on Instagram and stay tuned to all of Reverb's socials for all the details concerning this thing. I'm so excited. It's going to be a really, really good time. And yeah, let's see. Do I have anything else pressing you need to know about? Nothing too crazy. I think we should probably just insert the standard. Please share this episode with a friend, family, coworker. Anybody you think that would like this kind of content, if you feel like this brightens your day and you know somebody that, well, this will also help out, please share it with them.
It would make my day because, like I said before, I quite literally get paid by the download these days. So every little bit helps. This helps. The fact that you're listening to this right now is literally helping me directly and very, very, like, a lot. I don't know what I was going to say there, but very a lot. Substantially, that's the word I was looking for. You're substantially helping me just by listening to this right now. And also a big shout out to all of the Patreon subscribers. The Patreon subscribers also help a lot, and they get extra content for it because that's just how it rolls over there. So for as little as $5 a month, you can get extra audio content coming right to your ears. And sometimes that is more conversations like this. Sometimes it's conversations with me and my good friend Justin Porter in the Shred Shed. Sometimes it's demos. Sometimes it's sneaky stuff that no one sees coming. You never know what it is, but it's always going to be some sort of guitar-related audio content. And it's all over there on patreon.com/tonemob for anybody that can support over there. So thank you very much. I'll talk to you next week. Goodbye. One last thing before we totally sign off here. I just want to remind you that if you do any shopping at Stringjoy, that's Stringjoy Guitar Strings made in Nashville, that will help me out as well. As I've said for years, I'm heavily involved in that company, and I really do think they're making the best products on the market. So if you would like to try custom strings, go to tonemob.com/stringjoy and check them out today. I seriously love what the team down there is doing. I help them out with all kinds of things, and by you supporting them, you are also supporting me as well. And hey, you need some strings, so why not get some custom strings just for your guitar and playing style? Again, the link for that is tonemob.com/stringjoy, and that will take you right to their website, and you can do all your shopping through there, and that will help everyone involved out. So thank you very much. Talk to you next time. We are brought to you by the wonderful folks at Gun Street Wiring Shop. Yes, Gun Street Wiring Shop. I've talked about them before. I used to say based out of Bend, Oregon, but guess what? Sean moved to my neck of the woods. Sean's in Portland. Sean is awesome and has helped me with a bunch of stuff lately. And if you have wiring needs for your guitar, he can help you too. If you want to get weird with it, he can get weird. If you just need to spruce things up a little bit, there's your guy. He takes all the guesswork out of doing your guitar wiring, and he makes it simple, and his customer service is top-notch, and I can't say enough good things about Gun Street as a company. I really respect Sean and what he's all about, and the product is top-notch. I've got 3 different guitars that now have Gun Street harnesses in them, and I could not be happier. So go to GunStreetWiringShop.com and check them out.